I come from Des Moines. Somebody had to. When you come from Des Moines, you either accept the fact without question and settle down with a local girl named Bobby and get a job at the Firestone factory and live there forever and ever, or you spend your adolescence moaning at length about what a dump it is and how you can't wait to get out, and then you settle down with a local girl named Bobby and get a job at the Firestone factory and live there forever and ever. Hardly anyone ever leaves.
Bill Bryson is the UK's biggest-selling non-fiction author since official records began. In The Lost Continent, which is described as his hilarious first travel book, although we'll discover that there was one before that later on in this interview, he chronicled a trip in his mother's Chevy around small-town America. It was followed by Neither Here Nor There, an account of his first trip across Europe.
Things had not started well. I had overslept at the hotel, missing breakfast, and had to leap into my clothes. I couldn't find a cab, and had to drag my ludicrously overweighted bag 8 blocks through slush to the central bus station. I had had huge difficulty persuading the staff at the Kreditkassen Bank on Karl Johansgate to cash sufficient traveler's checks to pay the extortionate 1,200 kroner bus fare. They simply could not be made to grasp that the William Maguire Bryson on my passport and the Bill Bryson on my traveler's checks were both me.
Other travel books include Notes from a Small Island, the massive bestseller about the UK, A Walk in the Woods, a trip along the Appalachian Trail with Stephen Katz, and Observations on Australia in the book Down Under, or if you're in America, In a Sunburned Country. He then turned his attention to history and science with his book A Really Short History of Nearly Everything, his memoir The Life and Times of the Thunderbolt Kid, his look around his own house with At Home, and his new book One Summer, America, 1927.
It is impossible to imagine what it must have been like to be Charles Lindbergh in that summer. From the moment he left his room in the morning, he was touched and jostled and bothered. Every person on earth who could get near enough wanted to grasp his hand or clap him on the back. He had no private life anymore. Shirts he sent to the laundry never came back. Chicken bones and napkins from his dinner plate were fought over in kitchens. He could not go for a walk or pop into a bank or drugstore. If he went into a men's room, people followed. Checks, he wrote, were rarely cashed. Recipients preferred to frame them instead. No part of his life was normal, and there was no prospect that it ever would be again. As Lindbergh was discovering, it was a lot more fun to get famous than to be famous. His tour consisted of 69 overnight stops and 13 touch stops, where Lindbergh landed long enough to greet officials and say a few words, but did not otherwise linger. He also flew by request over scores of small towns, but only if they agreed to paint their town name on a rooftop for the benefit of other aviators. In communities where he could not land, he dropped leaflets that read, "Greetings. Because of the limited time and the extensive tour of the United States now in progress to encourage popular interest in aeronautics, it is impossible for the Spirit of St. Louis to land in your city. This message from the air, however, is sent you to express our sincere appreciation of your interest in the tour and in the promotion and extension of commercial aeronautics in the United States."
That was Bill Bryson reading from his brand new book, One Summer, America, 1927. And I'm delighted to say he joins me now in the Talking Book Studios.
Well, thank you for having me.
Now, you're in the RNIB Talking Book Studios reading your new book, One Summer.
Yes, and the summer is about the summer of 1927 in America, when all of this amazing stuff happened, mostly to do with popular culture. But it was the summer in which Charles Lindbergh flew the Atlantic. It was the summer in which Babe Ruth hit 60 home runs, which if you're a baseball fan is a huge thing. It was the summer in which the anarchists Sacco and Vanzetti were executed, which was a very big story at the time. It was the summer in which they invented television and in which radio came of age by the starting of network radio broadcasts in America. And lots of other things. It was the summer of the great Mississippi flood, the worst natural disaster in modern American history. It was the summer they filmed The Jazz Singer, the first talking picture, which obviously completely transformed popular entertainment. And just lots and lots of other things, all happening in this one summer. Almost all of it happened in the United States, and the rest of the world was strangely quiet that year. Everything happened in America.
Now, was it coincidence that you discovered all these events happening at the same time?
Pretty much. I mean, the starting point was that I had always been fascinated from childhood somehow by the idea that Charles Lindbergh and Babe Ruth had done these two things, these two iconic American events, at the same time. And I'd had it in mind for a long time that it might be an interesting approach to try to write a dual biography of these two iconic American figures, but with the narrative trajectory sort of heading for intersection at this one summer when the two moments came together. And then when I looked into it, I discovered that actually they were only a small part of what happened in the summer of 1927. There were all these other things going on as well. It was the summer they started building Mount Rushmore, for instance. It was just one thing after another. And the more I looked into it, the more I discovered that it was. What's amazing about the summer was all the stuff that happened and how it all kind of interconnected in ways that have never really been noticed before, because nobody's ever really written about them as a mass of events. People have written biographies of Lindbergh or biographies of Babe Ruth or that kind of thing, but haven't looked at them all as a great mass of events.
Is it very much like At Home, which was sort of your home was a starting point for a collection of different histories? Is one summer sort of the same idea?
Yeah, in a sense. I mean, in a sense that it's bringing together a lot of disparate things that aren't usually brought together. But here, I mean, At Home, I was really much more indulgent because I could go almost any direction I wanted to with it. I mean, because almost everything is pertinent to the history of domesticity in one way or another. This one, I was locked in. I was fixed on having to write about those things that were actually immediately pertinent to the summer of 1927. So this was much more much more confined, which in a lot of ways was great for me, because I didn't have to go looking all over the place. I could keep focused on one particular summer. For a man who changed the world, Henry Ford traveled in very small circles. He resided his whole life within a dozen miles of his birthplace, a farm at Dearborn, just outside Detroit. He saw little of the wider world and cared even less for it. He was defiantly narrow-minded, barely educated, and at least close to functionally illiterate. His beliefs were powerful but consistently dubious, and made him seem, in the words of the New Yorker, mildly unbalanced. He did not like bankers, doctors, liquor, tobacco, idleness of any sort, pasteurized milk, Wall Street, overweight people, war, books or reading, J.P. Morgan and Company, capital punishment, tall buildings, college graduates, Roman Catholics, or Jews. Especially, he didn't like Jews. Once he hired a Hebraic scholar to translate the Talmud in a manner designed to make Jewish people appear shifty and avaricious. His ignorance was a frequent source of wonder. He believed that the earth could not support the weight placed on it by skyscrapers, and that eventually cities would collapse in on themselves, as in some kind of biblical apocalypse. Engineers explained to him that a large skyscraper typically weighed about 60,000 tons, while the rock and earth excavated for the foundations would weigh more like 100,000 tons, so that skyscrapers actually reduced the burden on the earth beneath them. But Ford was unpersuaded. He seldom let facts or logic challenge the certainty of his instincts.
You're in the Talking Book Studios in Camden reading One Summer, but in the past I've heard your books read by people like Bill Roberts or Kerry Shale or a multitude of different narrators. But a few years back you started doing them yourself. Was there a reason for that?
Well, two reasons really. One was that in America, the audio publishers in America started, strongly encouraging me to read my own books. I guess there's more of an impulse over there to get the authors to read their own books if they're willing to do so.
Mm.
And partly it was also that some of my books had been read in America by Americans who were very good readers, but weren't necessarily familiar with the subjects I was writing about. And I mean, one of the things I remember was cringing when I read or listened to audio recordings of Like Notes from a Small Island, my book about Britain, because the reader, although a very gifted reader, I mean, he was good at animation and all of that, he made a lot of very basic mistakes in pronunciation.
Mm.
I don't remember specifics, but things like saying Edinburgh or Glasgow and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which made me look a little bit, out of touch, particularly as I'm supposed to be writing with some authority about the British Isles.
Mm-mm.
The one thing that you can guarantee is that if there is then a mistake in pronunciation, I've got nobody to blame but myself.
I wandered through the city, examining hotels from the street, but they all seemed a bit grand for me, and eventually ended up at the Central Tourist Office, feeling mildly lost and far from home. I wasn't quite sure what I was doing here. I looked through racks of leaflets for shire horse centers, petting zoos, falconry centers, miniature pony centers, model railways, butterfly farms, and something called, I regret to say, Twiggy Winky's Farm and Hedgehog Hospital, none of which seemed to address my leisure requirements.
That was a clip from an American version of Notes from a Small Island. Now, you were initially famous for travel books, and as with many interviews, I've asked listeners to tweet or email in questions for you, and one lovely one was, did your walk in the woods put you off travel?
It took me off. It put me off going for long-distance hikes in the American wilderness. That's for damn sure. But no, it didn't put me off travel at all. I still love travel. Part of the problem I have is that I haven't entirely run out of places to write about, but I have, because of the kinds of books I write, I have a much more limited range of places I can comfortably write about. I couldn't go to a third world country and write the kinds of books I write about because my books are based on the idea that I can actually kind of take the mickey out of the countries I'm writing about. And if you're doing that, in Canada or France or Britain or, a big, powerful, rich first world nation, that's one thing. But to go and do those kinds of jokes at the expense of people in, India or parts of Africa or, the third world, it could seem quite cruel. And I certainly don't want to do that. It could also be, even if I'm not being cruel, it could just kind of come across as in bad taste or as not very good. So, there's whole areas of the world that my kind of humor wouldn't work and I wouldn't want to go to write about in the kinds of books people expect me to write. But that isn't to say I wouldn't want to go there and have the experiences myself just for the pleasure of it.
Did you find writing your African diary quite hard then?
I did indeed, and that was sort of a test to see, to test this proposition. And if you look at African Diary, I mean, you can see it's struggling to be funny because it's, I'm very limited in what I can write about. We were visiting, one of the world's most horrible slums in Nairobi, and there was just no jokes there. I mean, this isn't something you can make jokes about. There's just absolutely no scope for jokes at all. So the jokes that are in African Diary are really all inward directed at me and the people, the British people I was traveling with. And it was, it was really quite limiting. It would have been hard to do a full-blown book that way. So, I mean, I realized when I was doing it, I kind of suspected before I did it that would be a challenge, and so it proved.
Now, you mentioned there one country that you haven't written about, Canada.
Canada. I love Canada. Canada's a country I would be very happy to make fun of or, to make jokes about. And I think, they would be, I'm sure, very happy to have me do so because, they could take it. It's obviously a big, grown-up, robust nation. And, I wouldn't be patronizing them or really insulting them. I'd just be kind of teasing them. So I would love to do Canada. The problem is that most of the world has a kind of natural bias against Canada, in that it is just famous for being dull, and people are not automatically interested in it at all.
Now, there's a clip coming up I chose specifically to go with this next question, which came in on Twitter. Do dogs hate you that much?
They do, absolutely. Every single one of them. But no, there's one exception. Now, my daughter recently got a little Cocker Spaniel, a puppy, and he seems to love me, and I'm happy to love him in return, but that doesn't in any way nullify all the other dogs hating me in the world.
I guess it would take about 20 minutes to cut through the park, or the reserve, as Australians call these things, and I was probably about halfway along when, from an indeterminate distance off to the right, there came the bark of a dog, tentative and experimental, as if to say, "Who's that?" It wasn't very close or intimidating, but it was clearly the bark of a big dog. Something in its timbre said, "Meat-eater, black, very big, not too many generations removed from wolf." Almost in the same instant it was joined by the bark of a companion dog, also big, and this bark was decidedly less experimental. This bark said, "Red alert, trespasser on our territory." Within a minute they'd worked themselves up into a considerable frenzy. Nervously I quickened my pace. Dogs don't like me. It is a simple law of the universe, like gravity. I am not exaggerating when I say that I have never passed a dog that didn't act as if it thought I was about to take its alpo. Dogs that have not moved from the sofa in years will, at the sniff of me passing outside, rise in gorge and hurl themselves at shut windows. I have seen tiny dogs, no bigger than a fluffy slipper, jerk little old ladies off their feet and drag them over open ground in a quest to get at my blood and sinew. Every dog on the face of the earth wants me dead. And now here I was, alone in an empty woods, which suddenly seemed very large and lonely, and two big and angry-sounding dogs had me in their sights.
Now, you mentioned earlier on a walk in the woods, and one of the questions that came in is, if you could have swapped Stephen Katz for any other travelling companion, famous, not famous, alive or historical, who would it have been?
Oh, well, at the time, I would have swapped him for anybody. Anybody. any other human being. I would have swapped him for, you know, a plank of wood at some points. But looking back, I couldn't possibly have swapped him for any other human being. I mean, he stood by me on that walk. He didn't have to be there. He could have quit at any time, and I wouldn't have blamed him at all, because he didn't have to be there. I did, you know. I had a vow and a contract to write a book. He could have left at any time, and I wouldn't have blamed him at all. But he, in fact, he didn't. He stood by me. And because of who he was and the sort of person he was, you know, he made the book. If Stephen Katz, the real guy, hadn't been there with me and hadn't been doing all of those things and saying all those crazy things, the book would not have ever been, could not possibly have been what it turned out to be. So, you know, my debt to him is immense. In retrospect, I wouldn't have taken anyone else.
Now, there was talk for a while of a film starring Paul Newman and Robert Redford. Are you disappointed that didn't go ahead?
Yeah, I mean, of course, it was going to be their reunion movie. Poor Paul Newman passed away, which was very great disappointment to Robert Redford. a personal disappointment, because they were friends and he liked him very much. But I mean, in a kind of professional sense, with regard to the movie, it was also a disappointment to him. They're still talking about getting it made, but you know whether that will ever happen or not, I don't know. The last I heard, it was going to be Robert Redford and Nick Nolte playing the two lead roles. Robert Redford is going to be me, and Nick Nolte was going to be Katz. But they were obviously, because of the age differences and just the differences, you know, of other kinds, they were going to adjust the story somewhat. So stay faithful to the idea of it, but change some of the personal specifics a little to suit the different ages and the fact that this is happening now in 2013 rather than nearly 20 years ago now.
And there must have been something nice about the fact of Robert Redford playing you in a movie.
Oh, yeah, but even better was originally it was going to be Julia Roberts was going to be playing his wife. And so the idea of me being married to Julia Roberts had a certain a certain kind of theoretical appeal to it.
Katz was crouched over the camp stove, boiling a pan of water. We seemed to be the only campers awake. It was cold, but perhaps just a trifle warmer than the day before, and a low dawn sun burning through the trees looked cautiously promising. "How do you feel?" he said. I flexed my legs experimentally. "Not too bad, actually." "Me either." He poured water into the filter cone. "I'm going to be good today," he promised. "Good." I watched over his shoulder. "Is there a reason," I asked, "why you are filtering the coffee with toilet paper?"
I threw out the filter papers.
I gave a sound that wasn't quite a laugh. "They couldn't have weighed 2 ounces.
"I know, but they were great for throwing. Fluttered all over."
He dribbled on more water. "The toilet paper seems to be working okay, though."
That's Bill Roberts reading from A Walk in the Woods by Bill Bryson. Now, Bill, what do you actually read for fun?
Oh, that's a really good question. And the answer is, honestly, very little. Simply because almost all the reading I do is directed at work I'm working on. You know, that's not a hardship. I mean, if I'm doing a book on Australia or Canada or whatever it happened to be, that's what I'm reading about. I'm reading on that subject. And I don't resent that at all, because the time I'm working on the book, that's what I want to know. It's what I'm, you know, if I'm doing a book on Australia, there isn't anything at all written about Australia or by an Australian or to do with Australia that isn't of potential interest to me. So that's what I, you know, that's what I read. And when I finish, then I move on to the next project and I start reading about whatever is relevant to that. And it leaves very little time for you know, discretionary reading, which I sometimes am slightly sad about, but that's just the life I have. So the basic answer is that when I'm reading for pleasure, there's something wrong, because I don't have time to read for pleasure.
Now, I heard in researching your new book one summer, you read every single New York Times from that summer. Now, was there a moment when you looked up and thought, "Oh, it's 2013?
It didn't ever get quite as bad as that. But I did, I mean, it was a real pleasure to do, and it was a lot, I wasn't quite sure what it would be like, but it was actually terrific, because, you know, I'm not a historian, and so if I'd been doing a book about, I don't know, Jacobean England or something, I probably would have struggled with the research. But the great thing about 1927, being able to look at newspapers and contemporary magazines and things, is that it was, although it's, you know, getting on for a century ago, it's still very accessible. You can read the New York Times, or indeed the London Times or any other newspaper from that time, and the language is, you know, identical more or less to what we have today. So it doesn't feel dated and distant and hard to kind of get your head around. And I'm pretty sure that having grown up in the 50s in America, in a time when, you know, before air conditioning being really popular, and that the 50s was, I think, I've convinced myself that having grown up in the 50s and being able to remember that from my childhood, it's easier for me to project myself back into the 20s, because I don't think it was all that different in a lot of respects.
Actually, talking of research, that something occurred to me. At the end of Down Under, there's a scene where you're looking at some stromatolites, and then after that you started working on a short history of nearly everything. Are the two related? Was one the seed for another?
It was indeed, yes. I had kind of had it in mind for a long time that I wanted to do a book about science and, you know, just look at the universe and the world around us and how we got here. Because I'd always been so terrible at science in school, and I'd been bored by it. And I always thought, well, that's weird, because, you know, science is interesting. I mean, it's got to be interesting. It explains who we are and how we got here and what we're doing here. And I've always been interested in television programs like Horizon and Equinox and things like that. So I couldn't understand why there was no level at which I had been able to engage with science. I wanted to see if I could do it in a book of my own. So that was the idea of it. And the time that I had the kind of inspiration to go in that direction was when I was at this place called Shark Bay in Western Australia, where these amazing, very, very sort of primeval organisms grow and just off in the shallow waters just off the coast, called stromatolites, which are exactly like the sort of organisms you would have found on Earth hundreds of millions of years ago, before there was any life on dry land. And so that kind of got me started on it, yeah.
Now, when you said to your publishers, I'm not doing travel books anymore, I'm going to do a history of absolutely everything, were they a bit worried?
They were. I didn't say to them, I'm stopping doing travel books. I just said to them, I'd like to take a break from doing what I've been doing for all these years and do something different. And I think they thought that meant I was just going to do it this one time and then get back to what I normally do. And so they indulged me in it. They allowed me to go ahead and do this. And it was very good of them, and they supported the book. I mean, they got behind it, and they marketed it and everything. And amazingly, it did really well. It got good reviews, and it sold really well. In fact, I think it's Short History, nearly everything is sold globally. It sold far more than any of my other books. So that kind of redefined everything, and since that time, they've allowed me a lot more latitude in what I do.
Not only have you been lucky enough to be attached since time immemorial to a favored evolutionary line, but you have also been extremely, make that miraculously, fortunate in your personal ancestry. Consider the fact that for 3.8 billion years, a period of time older than the Earth's mountains and rivers and oceans, every one of your forebears on both sides has been attractive enough to find a mate, healthy enough to reproduce, and sufficiently blessed by fate and circumstances to live long enough to do so. Not one of your pertinent ancestors was squashed, devoured, drowned, starved, stuck fast, untimely wounded, or otherwise deflected from its life's quest of delivering a tiny charge of genetic material to the right partner at the right moment, to perpetuate the only possible sequence of hereditary combinations that could result, eventually, astoundingly, and all too briefly, in you.
Now, on your publisher's website, it does list The Lost Continent as your first travel book, but I know, as I have a copy, there was one before that called Palace Under the Alps. What happened to that?
Well, Palace Under the Alps, and it is amazing that you have a copy, because you and I are probably the only two people who do. It was barely existed. What happened was, this was a long time ago when I was just a young journalist and recently arrived in Britain, and I had the idea to do a guidebook for Americans, primarily for Americans, on little-known tourist attractions in Europe, so that instead of just going to, Buckingham Palace or the Stonehenge and the kind of really obvious places, that I'd guide them to lesser-known museums and little quirky attractions. So that was the idea of the book, and I sold an American publisher on it, and they commissioned it and gave me a small amount of money to write the book, and I wrote it and turned in the manuscript, and then they essentially went out of business, and they rushed the book into print as a way of desperately trying to generate a little turnover as they were going under. And so the book was printed. I mean, some couple of thousand copies were actually, came in from the publishers. But it was never sold. It never went on sale in any kind of proper bookshops. It was remaindered instantly. And those 2,000 copies or so, they did go out into the world and they sloshed about. But there's not many of them, so you really are. There's a bit of a rarity for you to have one. How did you ever find it?
It was on Abe Books, and it's an American library book. It has the card in the front and the stamp on the side, but it's obviously a library book that's been sold on, and someone has seen the name and perhaps realised the value in it. It cost more than a new hardback, shall I say.
Well, I'm very honoured that you would invest in that. But it was an interesting experience to do it, and it was a real learning experience for me. But actually, I mean, I worked really hard on putting that book together, and because the publisher went out of business, I never really got anything for it.
Now, if the publisher's out of business, could it be something you could revisit and update?
Well, in theory, yeah, you could. And I mean, I had a wonderful time doing it, and it's the kind of thing that I would enjoy doing, but I've got so many other commitments and so many other things that I really want to do. And the most dispiriting part of it all is I'm getting older and older. Every day I seem to get older than I was the day before. And I've reached an age where I've realized that I actually only have a finite amount of time left. You know, even if I lead a good old life, it's only a few time to write a few more books. So I have to be a lot more selective and careful now. You know, 10 or 15 years ago, I sort of thought, like most of us do, that I could do an infinite number of books because I didn't need to worry about limits of mortality. But I turned 60, and so you start thinking, gosh, you know, I'm only going to write so many more books before I either go senile or I'm actually carted off.
Now, sort of on that subject, but there is a sort of legacy and a memorial to you already. What's it like having a library named after you?
Oh, that's fantastic. It's I should perhaps explain that I was chancellor at Durham University for 7 years, and which was one of the great experiences of my life. I mean, it's a great honor, as you can imagine, to be chancellor of a university. And Durham is an especially agreeable place to be chancellor. It's a very, very beautiful city, wonderful cathedral there, lovely university, a very good university. So it was, you know, it was a wonderful experience, and I, you know, was very, very happy with it. And when I left, they renamed the library after me as a sort of memorial, and that was the best thing that anybody has ever done for me. Perhaps apart from my wife producing 4 children, but actually, you know, marrying me and staying with me for nearly 40 years. But in kind of, you know, day to day life, nothing has ever been more exciting to me than having a library named after me. I love libraries, and so to think that there is this building that will live on far after I do is a terribly comforting thought.
Now, you are at the end of a long day of recording one summer at the RNIB Talking Book Studio, so I don't want to keep you too long, but a little bird told me you're not getting much sympathy at home for the... They don't understand the level of concentration and exhaustion you get for reading a book.
No, because, you know, I mean, you sit here and you are just sitting all day, and it's not, you know, it's not physically a very exhausting thing. But it is tiring. And I suppose, you know, because what I'm saying to my wife in the evening is, no, we must go to the pub first for a couple of drinks because I've really, really earned it. And she doesn't see it as a really hard labor that merits going to the pub for an hour and a half before going to dinner. So it's something that we're just going to never quite be on the same page on.
I drove on into Des Moines, and it looked very large and handsome in the afternoon sunshine. The golden dome of the state capitol building gleamed. Every yard was dark with trees. People were out cutting the grass or riding bikes. I could see why strangers came in off the interstate looking for hamburgers and gasoline and stayed forever. There was just something about it that looked friendly and decent and nice. I could live here, I thought, and turned the car for home. It was the strangest thing, but for the first time in a long time, I almost felt serene.
Bill Roberts reading the end of The Lost Continent. And I must say thank you to Bill Roberts, who provided a lot of the clips in this interview. From RNIB Talking Books, if you're looking for The Lost Continent or Neither Here Nor There, they're available in a double audio volume. From RNIB, you can also get At Home, The Life and Times of the Thunderbolt Kid, Made in America, Mother Tongue, Notes from a Big Country, Notes from a Small Island, A Short History of Nearly Everything Shakespeare, The World as a Stage, and A Walk in the Woods. The books are also available commercially from audible.co.uk and the print versions wherever books are sold.
One Summer, America 1927 by Bill Bryson will be available in all formats, in Kindle, print and in audio, on September the 26th. Again, the audio version from audible.co.uk. For more information on RNIB Talking Books, head to www.rnib.org.uk.